Funding for WBUR comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Tomorrow marks the 49th anniversary of what historians widely regard as one of the greatest presidential speeches in U.S. history. As the nation reeled from the beatings of civil rights marchers in Selma, Alabama, President Lyndon Baines Johnson made a stirring call before Congress to ensure the voting rights of all black Americans.
There is no Negro problem. There is no Southern problem. There is no Northern problem. There is only an American problem.
This morning, WBUR's David Boeri reports on the making of what came to be known as the We Shall Overcome speech and the writer who composed it in a one-day dash to the deadline.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man and the destiny of democracy.
So began President Lyndon Johnson on March 15, 1965. He spoke to a nation sickened by the sight of state police and a sheriff's posse assaulting civil rights marchers in Selma the week before. He had an audience of 70 million television viewers who had seen for themselves clubs, bullwhips, and tear gas unleashed against people trying to register black Americans to vote. The veil was off the injustice. The president was throwing his heft and force into the cause before a special joint session of Congress.
It is wrong, deadly wrong, to deny any of your fellow Americans the right to vote in this country.
The voice belonged to Johnson, as did the conviction. But the lines were crafted by a young speechwriter who arguably pulled off one of the greatest deadline assignments in presidential history that day. It was a Monday, and Richard Goodwin wasn't at his best. He had arrived at the White House on banker's hours after a late night of what he called post-prandial drinks and socializing.
And I got home and I picked up my White House telephone. There were no messages for me. And I said, good, now I don't have to write it.
The president had decided on Sunday to address Congress the next night. But when the pajama-clad president woke early Monday to the news his right-hand man, Jack Valenti, had assigned the speech to someone else, he exploded.
Johnson looked at him. He said, you did what? He said, don't you know that a liberal Jew has his hands on the pulse beat of America, and you assign this speech to a Texas public relations man? He said, get Dick on it.
Soon, Dick was on it, with no time to spare. Now 82, the luminary remembers Valenti waiting for him at the office that day, jumping up and down. Goodwin had just 8 hours. He started channeling his own ideals and his own experience of rabid anti-Semitism. To deny a man his hopes because of his color or race or the place of his birth, he wrote,
is not only to do injustice, it is to deny America and to dishonor the dead who gave their lives for American freedom.
With incandescent language and the goal of moving men to action at long last, Goodwin linked the marches in Selma to the Minutemen of 1775 at the Rude Bridge in Concord, down the road from where he now lives. He connected them to veterans who fought for the cause of freedom in Korea in World War II. Author and historian Doris Kearns Goodwin says she fell in love with his speech before she ever met the speechwriter, whom she later married.
What you're calling forth are the memories of the people who came to America for a purpose. So it's part of what is a nation. I mean, it's what Lincoln called on in Gettysburg.
Dick Goodwin had entered the White House at 29 as an aide for John Kennedy before joining Johnson as his chief speechwriter. Here on that Monday, Goodwin had a rare opportunity at the heights of power to pour his own passion into a presidential speech.
Here there was no other side. Blacks had been marching for the right to vote. They'd been beaten up in the streets. I mean, nobody was out there saying Negroes shouldn't have the right to vote or the government shouldn't help them. So all the morality was on one side. And I felt that. I believed that and I felt it.
100 years after Lincoln, he wrote, emancipation was a proclamation and not a fact. and the Negro struggle showed a faith in democracy that shamed the nation.
A century has passed since the day of promise, and the promise is unkept. The time of justice has now come.
While Goodwin was giving birth to those lines, everyone bore the brunt of the waiting president's impatience, except Goodwin himself. No one dared interrupt or delay him. Jack Valenti would later call him as lovable as a forlorn porcupine. He said Goodwin held on to his speech until the last moment to prevent the speaker from messing around with it.
And not just the speaker, but the rest of the White House staff. Everybody want to get their hands on a presidential speech. And if you left it to them enough time before it had to be delivered, who knew what the hell they could do?
Pecking the keys of his manual typewriter with two fingers, Goodwin finished his last page, too late for revisions or rewriting. He called those hours his finest in politics. After a ride in the president's limo in a rumpled suit, Goodwin got to stand in the well of the House and see the president raise his arms for emphasis as he delivered what became the most famous line.
Their cause must be our cause, too. Because it's not just Negroes, but really it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome.
He said, and we shall overcome, and we shall overcome.
In Selma, John Lewis watched in amazement. His skull had been fractured by a police club the week before. Now he sat beside Martin Luther King. As Lewis told NPR a few years ago.
And tears came down his face. Dr. King started crying, and we all cried. And Dr. King said to me, John, we will make it to Montgomery, and the Voting Rights Act will be passed.
There was a sense of profound emotionalism about this.
Historian and LBJ biographer Robert Dalek.
And for Johnson to adopt the anthem of the civil rights movement, and especially for those who had been battling for decades, it made them cry. People understood that this was a transformative moment.
Senators and congressmen interrupted the speech 40 times with applause, at times standing and thunderous. If the goal of political speech is to move men to action, this was Johnson's and Goodwin's finest hour. Southern segregationists slumped in their chairs and sat on their hands. They knew they were done. 5 months later, Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and gave Goodwin the pen that's now on his wall.
Yes, it's Richard Goodwin's words, but it's very much Lyndon Johnson's speech.
It is the custom of presidential speechwriters to disavow ownership. Yet Goodwin would join Johnson that night in the presidential quarters.
Johnson had no desire to go to sleep. He knew he'd have a great triumph.
The two of them drinking scotch until 3, hoping the applause would never end. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm David Boyerie.